You're listening to Homicide Worldwide. Your hosts, Sally and Keita, would like to remind our listeners, the episodes deal with crimes that are graphic in nature and may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
As if by some horrible prediction, maybe even a premonition of sorts, Sally Lawrence could not have been more correct when it came to the fact that she would be killed by her soon-to-be ex-husband. She just didn't know how her death would happen or when the last day of her life would be, but it did happen, and in a way that she would never have thought of. The normal order of things is that once a marriage is over, the estranged couple live away from one another, hence the estrangement. But Ian and Sally remained in the same marital home, much to her chagrin, long after the marriage was over. And to be fair, it was a massive home, but not nearly big enough for the tension, anger, and bitterness that seeped between the former couple. A life that was once happily lived there, together, was replaced by resentment and animosity, which occupied every square foot, every inch, and every nook of the home. As Ian continued to squat, hiding away, plotting, and planning, he finally came up with his plan. Ian had an idea that was so extreme that he went so far as to put his own life, safety, and well-being into harm's way, just to make sure that Sally died on that October day. People who knew Sally said things like, "She was an inspirational, caring, kind young woman with a huge heart, and she was so full of life." They also said that on the day that Sally died, a part of us died with her. But why in the world would somebody who was described as Sally be murdered? Why were they separated to begin with? And just what made Sally Lawrence feel to her bones that Ian, the man that she once deeply loved, would eventually be the man who would take her life? This is episode 70 of Homicide Worldwide.
Hello, hello.
Hola.
Bien.
Bien, ¿y tú?
Mucho.
Pinche.
¿Dónde estás?
Ooh. That's all I know. That's all I got.
I don't actually speak any other languages other than Australian English. No, that's not true. I do speak a little bit of American English.
Yeah, you do.
I do. I have enough that I can get by. I can say things like kitty corner. When that was first said to me and it was explained to me what it was, I looked at the person and I said, "You mean diagonally opposite?" Like a total asshole. And
that is, but I love it.
Yeah, I really have to make that dry sound of my voice. But now I know what kitty corner is. It means diagonally opposite. So yeah, a little Australian, a little American, a little from column A and a little from column B. And here we are. Yeah. Well, friends, welcome to Homicide Worldwide. I am Sally, one of your co-hosts.
And I am Keita. I am your other co-host. And we are so glad that you have chosen to come back and be with us this week. The operative word here is chosen. Mm-hmm. So you made your choice to be here.
You made your bed and you're about to lie in it.
You really are.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to our fans. Thank you so much for all of your support. Please remember to subscribe, follow us on Instagram and on Twitter. You can find us on Twitter at HWWP10. That's 10. And you can follow us on Homicide Worldwide Podcast or Homicide Worldwide Podcast Production on Instagram. Remember to rate us with a 5-star, please. Keep your 1 stars to yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
And tell a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And if you like,
force a friend.
Force a friend. Please force them to start listening to us, starting with Joel Guy.
Yeah. That's right.
We also want to remind you guys about our Patreon. We also still have some tiny keychains. I haven't been able to even fucking give them away. So please check out our Patreon. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much it.
Or if you really want to get creative, buy two, make them into earrings.
Or give them as like a lump of coal Christmas present. I don't know. I don't care. Just fucking yeah, get just them out of my house.
Yeah, please. They're taking up so little room.
Yes, they are. They certainly are.
They certainly are. Go get it. Go get some social.
Okay, go get it.
We're going to start, as we often do, by giving you an overview of this case. It's a very straightforward case, but my goodness, what a little story it is.
Indeed.
In the early morning hours of October the 7th, 2012, Detective Inspector Neil Castle, it's his real name, but it sounds like it's not.
Oh, that's a bitchin' name.
It's a great name. He received a call about a car crash. So it's early in the morning, right after midnight. At about 6:30 p.m. the previous evening, on October the 6th, 2012, a red Peugeot had hit a tree after veering off a winding country road. This is in England, by the way. Ye olde England.
Mm-hmm.
Slash United Kingdom slash Britain. I don't know what you call yourself.
Brexit?
It's in Brexit.
It's in Brexit.
There were two people in this vehicle that had hit this tree. There was a husband and a wife. The husband had been driving, and the wife was next to him in the passenger seat. The woman had died at the scene, and the male driver had been taken to the hospital, apparently unconscious with possible brain injuries. The driver was soon identified as Ian Lawrence, a 53-year-old retired pilot. The dead passenger was his soon-to-be ex-wife, 47-year-old Sally Lawrence. They were in the middle of a bitter divorce.
Detective Castle was surprised to receive a call. He was a homicide investigator, and car crashes tended to be accidental in origin, not homicidal. Detective Castle's expertise was requested due to the odd behavior of the injured driver when he was first encountered by several Good Samaritans and EMTs who had arrived to assist. Those helpful bystanders and first responders had observed that the driver seemed to be feigning unconsciousness, and he was significantly less injured than his female passenger, who had sustained horrific, and we mean fucking horrific, and fatal injuries when her side of the car directly impacted into a tree.
Ian's faked unconsciousness and his exaggerated behavior was also noted by the emergency room nurse who tended to him when he arrived at the hospital, and she reported this to police. The police and fire personnel who had attended the scene noticed that there was an absence of those usual signs of a car accident. There were no skid marks to indicate braking. The dead victim's airbag had not deployed, although the driver's had. Her seatbelt was unbuckled, but the driver's seatbelt had been fully buckled, keeping him safe. And she had been killed instantly when the Peugeot hit the tree. Her husband had escaped death with only minor injuries. These unusual circumstances led to the call that woke Detective Neil Castle, as the facts seemed to point to something more sinister than a tragic but straightforward car accident.
You know, the faked unconsciousness and the exaggerated behavior that you were talking about, I just imagine him like pretending to be asleep, so injured, but like with one eye open, making sure that everybody sees him being so unconscious and injured.
It's funny that you should say that, because a phrase that came up many times when I was researching this case was like a child.
Yes. Like a child.
A lot of people said that, like a child. It was childlike. He was acting like you would expect a child to.
Mm-hmm.
Just when you thought he couldn't be emasculated or more of a shitty ass loser.
He was just a fucking stupid asshole. So, you know, Ian, get it together. The tale that we're going to share in this episode is indeed tragic, but it falls within our purview because of the role that Ian Lawrence played in the death of his wife, Sally. The more that investigators dug into the facts, the more disturbed the evidence made them. It all seemed to point to a successful attempt by Ian Lawrence to kill Sally, staging her murder to look like an accident. And who would accuse a grieving husband, like who in their right mind would ever accuse a grieving husband of murder when he himself had also sustained these injuries when the red Peugeot veered off the road and hit that tree in October?
As we've learned through our time together, dear listener, good forensic investigation reveals the messy truth. In this case, the evidence discovered by crime scene investigators supported the testimony of witnesses from Sally's life who described her fear that Ian would hurt her as they hammered out the details of their messy divorce. Her instincts were spot on. Ian couldn't accept that Sally had met someone else and moved on. He couldn't accept the terms regarding division of assets in the divorce. It would all be so much easier if Sally would just go away. And Ian Lawrence made that happen.
I just have to inject an opinion here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a correct opinion. So it's a fact.
Yeah, a correct opinion is indeed a fact.
It's never easier to kill somebody. It's just fucking not.
It's funny how people get to that. They're always just like, you know what? Divorce just seems like such a pain in the ass.
I should murder them and then cover it up because that's way more efficient.
You know, there's something that I'll say a little later down the way, but it's basically the statement by one of the people in this case just saying that he was so narcissistic that he couldn't imagine that what he was doing was obvious to other people because he considered himself so much smarter than other people.
Oh, God complex again.
Mm-hmm. It'll get you.
Why are there so many people who have this God complex?
They don't get criticized enough at appropriate developmental moments.
Oh, see, I was criticized left and right.
That's why we hate ourselves and that we're never enough for anybody, including ourselves. You're the worst!
Ian Lawrence was a retired airline pilot. Apparently, he was successful. I mean, he did manage to not crash a plane.
Apparently.
He was in what appeared to be a good marriage. He seemed really to have it all. However, he had had several failed businesses before his career as a pilot. And he relished the prestige that had been given to him once he found success in being a pilot. You know, you have to kind of assume that like a pilot or a surgeon or somebody who has like a big ass responsibility. So I feel like there is definitely like an element around people with careers like this because you have to be a certain level of arrogance, a certain level of confidence that the regular folk just aren't.
I do expect a little cockiness.
That's why it's the cockpit.
That's one of two reasons it's called the cockpit.
Wink, wink. We're talking to you. Wait, who is it?
Jeb, someone. Where there's sex in the air. Like you just don't care.
Spirit Fingers.
Spirit Finger Airlines. Oi. He definitely had this high responsibility job.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't find out any information about why he was let go. 2007 was when the financial thing hit, like the financial crisis hit, right? So it could have been that. But there was some indication that he was fired. But anyway, I couldn't find any information about that. He really seemed to have a decent career as a pilot early on.
Yes, he did.
And Sally had actually been in a marriage prior to her marriage to Ian. She was a divorced mother of two grown-up daughters when she met him. She had worked her way up to being the personal assistant to the managing director at a company that specialized in cleaning up chemical spills. It was a very important job, right?
Yeah.
She was known as a really positive person, very caring, with a huge enthusiasm for life. And her perspective on life was really a very optimistic and sort of forward-moving one. One of her friends called her, quote, a lovely, warm, genuine, kind person. I couldn't ask for a better friend, end quote.
I hope that's how you remember me.
That's why I'm putting it on your gravestone, baby.
You have a long list.
I know.
We've talked about this. There's a list.
It's going to be like a less of a gravestone, more of like a grave wall.
It looks like bullet points of my character.
Chapter one. All right.
At the time that Sally met Ian in the year 2000, the year of our Lord, the Y2K scare.
Y2K that we all survived. Planes falling from the sky.
Computers stopping working. Whatever will we do?
Skynet taking over. Didn't happen.
Sally was looking for a partner with whom to spend the next part of her life. And She was introduced to Ian by a mutual friend who also happened to be a pilot. Sally and Ian hit it off immediately, and they were soon engaged and married. The wedding was lavish. Indeed, it was 250 people. That's not insignificant. It was a big cathedral wedding, about 15,000 pounds worth of fireworks that lasted 40 minutes. You know what? That puts America to shame on the 4th of July.
Seriously, it does. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what that is in American money, but that sounds like a lot of freaking money. Like, when you spend 15,000 pounds on fireworks, that's a lot of fireworks.
40. That's a lot.
It takes 40 minutes for your wedding.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And they moved in together afterwards, and they began a new happy life as newlyweds, as you do. And Sally was soon impregnated with Ian's seed.
Oy.
And they had a son together, a boy they called William.
We don't believe that there's anything demonic about William. Just want to say that. Allegedly, there's nothing happening there.
No, the number of the beast is not.
Yeah, when we say seed, we don't mean demon seed. We mean it very much in the just general spermy way.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying that, Sally.
You're welcome. I like to clarify general sperm.
Gross.
To outside observers, Ian and Sally seem to have a pretty great marriage. Ian, however, really did like things his way in his marriage.
Oh, these guys.
I just don't know anything about that. He made most of the choices. He also had a tendency to be quite controlling and even domineering.
Mm.
But Sally really wanted a partner, and he had, you know, a lot of qualities that she liked. So she kind of overlooked some of these more troubling aspects of him.
I'd love to know what the qualities that she liked were. Maybe it was just like worldwide travel.
Maybe he gave good massages, or he was good at cooking like a Western omelet. I don't know.
He could have been.
Everyone likes something different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in 2007, things began to go wrong for the couple. Ian was laid off from his high-status, well-paying job, which was a huge impact to his self-esteem. You know, he liked to dick swing a lot. On the other hand, Sally's career and her paycheck were steadily growing, and she became the breadwinner and took on more of the financial decision-making. I mean, there's nothing worse, I think, for a man who's been in a high-power job like that to lose that and then have to rely on his wife. That sounds really sexist, and don't come for me because that's not what I mean.
No, but it is. I agree with you completely, and I think that was a really troubling, and I used the word earlier, it felt emasculating to him.
Yeah, I could see that from this perspective for sure. And this actually did create quite a deep resentment toward Sally. And it was said that he wouldn't have responded well to being challenged by a friend who knew them very well.
He would not have had that. He didn't like her to challenge him. He didn't like her to...
Don't look me in the eye.
Back away slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah, throwing sand to establish dominance. Yeah.
exactly.
But he was just very domineering. And I think to be put in that sort of lesser position as she became sort of stronger in the marriage really seemed to be a situation that was just quickly became untenable for him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And indeed, the stresses of this new dynamic seemed to trigger a personality change in Ian. His attitude towards his family started to become quite ugly and mean, especially towards Sally. She began to feel frightened of what he might do to her. And she expressed this to several people close to her. That initial strong emotional connection that they had felt at the beginning of their marriage, it crumbled and she became disillusioned. Sally indicated to Ian that she was deeply unhappy in their relationship and it just continued to deteriorate.
Yeah, I wonder what that conversation was like.
I bet that was so much fun.
Hey, Ian, I'm deeply unhappy. I don't care.
Let's talk about something else. Go away.
Yeah, let's talk about what I want to do. Although they still lived together in the family home, Ian and Sally no longer shared the same room. And Sally spent a lot of her time with her family in Derbyshire. In 2012, Sally filed for divorce. And this new line in the sand was unacceptable for Ian. It inflamed his anger like a fissure in his ass. At being rejected and being seen as a failure in his marriage in the eyes of the world. Because everybody knows, Ian, I didn't know who you were until this case.
That's right, exactly.
I wouldn't have thought of you at all. He could also see that the divorce was a way to cut him out of the share of the family home, which, by the way, was in his wife's name. Mm. Ian was enraged, and there was no way that Sally was going to do this to him.
The day before the murder, the couple had a huge argument. Ian was demanding more money from the sale of the house, asking for Sally to reconcile with him, telling her she needed to stay with him. And they raged at each other and didn't come to any kind of an agreement. She was pretty much like, we're done here. What are you even talking about us getting back together?
You need to stay with me. I have nothing to offer you, but you need to stay with me.
It's like the core of narcissism is insecurity, right? It's getting people to do what you want them to do so they'll stay with you and not reject you, right?
Yeah.
It's the core of it. Well, she wanted to move on with her life, and Ian was just not going to let Sally go. And she kind of sensed this. She shared those fears that Ian would hurt her. One particular date that was coming up was causing Ian a lot of concern. And that date was October 8th, 2012. Keen observers will note that's actually 2 days after Sally was murdered. So just keep that in your mind. So he had this date in his mind. It was coming up. And this was the day that something called a decree nisi, a Latin term. It sounds super lame. It's something that happens in a divorce proceeding. And the decree nisi confirms that the court doesn't see any reason why you can't get divorced. It just says there's no weird reason. Everything has been satisfied. All of the legal requirements to obtain a divorce have been met. You can go ahead with it. So it's kind of when you say the decree nisi happens here, it's like that's kind of the end of your marriage when the divorce begins.
Mm.
So Ian's anxiety was really rising as that date approached, and he could see that Sally would not reconcile with him and that she would not agree to his demands for a bigger share of the house's equity, and again, which was all in Sally's name. Oh, and she also had life insurance because of course she did.
Obviously.
Everybody does. £250,000 worth of it.
I actually don't have life insurance.
I actually canceled my life insurance earlier this year.
Yeah. I want to be worth more to my husband alive than dead.
Exactly.
That's fair.
I don't think you need to give anybody any reason to kill you.
No.
Or to benefit from your death.
There's already so many reasons. I just took one off the table.
Exactly.
In the weeks before her death, Sally confided in a friend and coworker named Catherine Wells. She told Catherine that she was scared of Ian. She told Catherine that she was afraid Ian would kill me one day. She slept in a separate bedroom from Ian and wedged her door to stop him from entering. That's not great.
It's not when you feel that level of fear.
That is a red flag.
It's a big red flag.
That's like a lot of them.
Right, there are, but like wedging your door at night, that's one of the bigger ones.
That's a massive red flag. Sally's fears that Ian would hurt her intensified. She shared with one of her daughters that she saw, quote, evil in his eyes, end quote, and that she was scared of being in the house alone with Ian. Sally was right to be afraid. Ian knew that if Sally died before the decree nisi, her assets would fall to him and so would the life insurance payout. And in Ian's mind, his choices narrowed until killing Sally became the only viable path forward. He began to plan her murder, knowing he needed to ensure that he appeared completely innocent.
By the day of Sally's murder, on October the 6th, 2012, Ian Lawrence had already singled out the spot where he would commit this murder on Gartree Road. He was well familiar with this area and it suited his purpose. One particular bend in the road had a large tree with all this kind of clear open ground in front of it. He also chose a weekend when their son William, at this point who was 10 years old, was away on a school trip.
Ugh. Always thinking of others, Ian.
Yeah. It's so considerate when you kill a kid's mom to just make sure that the kid's out of town at the time. It's really a nice thing to do.
Yeah. You don't want to cause any kind of permanent emotional scars.
No, you don't want to traumatize the child.
No, certainly not. Ian really thinks ahead.
He does.
Yeah. Well, Ian disabled the passenger airbag 6 trips prior to the fatal one in preparation for Sally's murder. He selected that time on Saturday evening when he knew that Sally would be leaving the house to get into her car to drive to Darby, and he waited for that exact moment.
On October the 6th, 2012, at about 6:20 p.m., Sally got into Ian's car, and we don't know how he was able to achieve that. So many of her friends and family testified that she would not have done that without coercion. There was a couple of reasons for this. First of all, Sally was a bit of a neat freak, unlike myself. And her own car was tidy and clean, and Ian's was messy and gross, and she hated that.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't like to travel with him, and she certainly didn't like to get into his nasty-ass car. So how was he able to get her into that car? That's quite the mystery. In the sentencing statement, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but in the sentencing statement from the judge following his guilty verdict, the judge addressed this specifically. He said, quote, "How you got Sally into your car, and whether by trickery or force, no one but you can know. I suspect it was a combination of the two. However you achieved it, she cannot have imagined what you were planning to do next." End quote.
When I was listening to you read that, the first thing that popped into my head was, I wonder if he said that it had something to do with William, their son. Because if she was not willing to go anywhere with him or to get into that shitbox car of his, I can imagine that the only way that she would be if there was a quote unquote emergency or some kind of something and we have to go together and, you know, something has happened to William, we need to go. And she got into the car because it was her child. Because if it's like that between two people, what other thing could you say that would get her in the car without force or without any kind of physical connection to get her into the car, you know?
Yeah.
If she got in willingly and was sitting in that front passenger seat willingly, my first thought is that it had something to do with the child.
Like something has happened, we have to go right now.
Yeah, because any mother would automatically say, fuck it, I don't care about your dirty car, get me to my kid.
Right, there's that. There's so many weird questions. I was also thinking of the fact that if he was anticipating that she was about to receive massive, massive head trauma, that he could potentially have punched her, rendered her unconscious, and then just put her in the front seat. And she would have just kind of been slumping there. And then he would have hit the tree. He wouldn't have even had to buckle her in. And then any trauma that she would have sustained immediately prior to that accident, I think probably would have been obliterated as her face and her head were essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows, quite honestly, but how he got her into that car is a mystery.
Total mystery.
Yeah. And because he still maintains his innocence like an asshole.
Of course he does.
Of course he does.
Couldn't have possibly been at fault. As they drove and the tree came into sight in that bend in the road, Ian executed his plan. As he approached the spot on Gartree Road, which was his intended target, he quickly reached over to Sally's side of the car and unbuckled her seatbelt. At this point, Ian was completely committed to his plan, knowing that Sally had no protection and that he was secured by both his seatbelt and his airbag. Ian aimed the car and accelerated so that the passenger side of the Peugeot struck the tree head-on at over 50 miles an hour. To improve the odds of his own survival, Ian quickly got himself into a brace position immediately before the car hit the tree. Now, if you don't know what a brace position is, you have your arms, like your forearm, sort of crisscrossed in front of you so that you're protecting your head and your face.
And you also just kind of like bunch yourself up to sort of protect your torso and your insides and to protect as much as you can, because when you decelerate really quickly, your internal organs move around very rapidly inside your body. And that's why people often get like internal injuries.
Total body deceleration.
That'll do it.
He also did have his airbag still in working order.
Mm-hmm. At his seatbelt. Decelerating rapidly like that, our bodies are not meant to do that.
No.
And that's really what happened and how Sally died here. I mean, as the car decelerated from 50 miles an hour to 0 miles per hour in an instant, Sally's inertia caused her body to continue moving forward at that same deadly speed. And she died instantly as her head and her upper body smashed into the dashboard and the windshield with no protection, then bounced back to rest on the passenger seat. She was probably dead by the time that she and the car became still.
Mm.
Investigators called her injuries, quote, catastrophic, end quote.
Jeez.
And you don't need to use a lot of imagination to understand the weight carried by that word. But next to her, Ian Lawrence would have opened his eyes with, you know, the sounds of the crash around him, like, you know, wheels bumping around on the road and things spinning and everything getting very still. He would have opened his eyes. He would have realized that he was still alive and that he had survived. He would have looked next to him and seen his wife dead. And he would have thought it worked. He would have thought that he had gotten away with murder. Ian suffered only a few bruises while Sally was pretty much unrecognizable in the passenger seat next to him.
Oh, such a terrible way to die.
I have to wonder what, I don't want to ponder this too deeply, but I always imagine if she was conscious and he hadn't knocked her out or something in her last few seconds, I wonder what that experience was like for her. Did she know what was happening when they were driving towards the tree and he had reached down and unbuckled? Was she aware of that? When he was in the brace position, like, what would it have been like in those last few seconds of her life? Did she have an awareness of what was being done to her? It's very hard to know how much warning she had, if any. There's some things that only he will ever know.
I feel like he would have wanted to watch her suffer. Yeah, it doesn't seem like he'd have a lot of humanity around him.
Yeah, it's a very cold way to take someone out, especially someone who's the mother of your 10-year-old son.
Well, first on scene were Gareth Unkles and his wife, yet another Sally.
So many Sallys.
Yes. And Gareth Unkles bears no relation to Paul Onions, which if you are a longtime listener, you'll know exactly which episode that's from. Mm-hmm. I'm not giving you any hints. If you don't know, you're just going to have to go back in the catalog.
I love all these British names. Unkles, Onions.
Unkles and Onions.
Yep.
Well, Gareth Unkles was driving with his family on Gartree Road when he saw, just off the road ahead, a car had collided with a tree. Gareth and his wife, also named Sally, as I said, quickly went to the car to give help. Gareth said that Sally Lawrence was slumped forward with her head toward her knees and that she did not appear to be wearing a seatbelt. He also noticed that although the driver's side airbag had deployed, the one on the passenger side had not.
Red flag. So many red flags. Sally Wright, who, that's W-R-I-G-H-T.
Whereas your Sally Wright, R-I-G-H-T.
Always right.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Gareth Unkle's wife. It's all getting very confusing.
It's starting to get confusing.
Right. Well, I'm just going to call her Witness Sally. So they've got Witness Sally and Victim Sally. And if you want to get super confusing, we've also got Host Sally. That's me.
Mm-hmm.
There's all your Sally's explained. So Witness Sally also gave a testimony later about what she saw. She said that Victim Sally was slumped forward, just like her husband had described. She said the injured woman's head was kind of leaning down towards the handbrake. And she said that the driver's seatbelt was buckled. Witness Sally tried to feel Ian Lawrence's pulse to see if he was alive. And he was. And so when she asked him, are you okay? He grunted at her in acknowledgement. So unconscious and disoriented.
Isn't he?
If you can grunt, you can understand what's being said to you. If you're acknowledging it.
If you can grunt, you're fine.
Yeah, you're fine. Get the hell up.
Bitch.
Yeah.
Well, Peter Hawkins was a retired firefighter who happened to be driving that road just minutes after the crash. He stopped and hurried to the red Peugeot where Gareth and Witness Sally were already trying to assist. Peter Hawkins immediately saw that Sally was massively injured, certainly beyond medical help, and she was likely already dead. She had extensive injuries to her head and her upper torso. Peter Hawkins would later testify that, quote, I did suspect that she was dead. Looking at the scene, looking at the individual, I knew it wasn't good. By looking at her, I knew it was too late. End quote.
Ian Lawrence was only lightly injured. He was kind of slumped in the driver's seat and he was still alive.
Why did he live through this?
Right away, Peter Hawkins, this retired firefighter, noticed that something was amiss. the driver appeared to be faking unconsciousness. Oh, I'm really disoriented after the accident that gave me a concussion, maybe.
But not really.
But not really. When Peter Hawkins later spoke at Ian Lawrence's trial, he testified that, quote, "It was as if a child was squeezing his eyes shut, pretending to be asleep." "He was squeezing, but the eye was twitching," end quote. It's so lame. He's just so lame.
He's so lame.
Peter Hawkins was a pretty important witness because he'd worked on a lot of accident scenes in his firefighting career. He knew what an unconscious person did and didn't look like. That's a detail that maybe like a less experienced witness might have overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
They might have been like, oh, he seemed really groggy from the accident, right? But they might not have been like, he was faking it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just pure luck that somebody who knew what many unconscious people had previously looked like was one of the first to arrive on scene. So that was good for the prosecutors.
Yeah, definitely. EMTs who arrived on the scene noticed a discrepancy between Ian Lawrence's injuries and his behavior. He had no apparent head injuries, no cuts, no contusions, and yet he was displaying behavior that would put him at a 7 on the Glasgow Coma Scale, which is used to indicate someone's consciousness and alertness after an accident. The scoring by EMTs based on Ian's behavior would indicate a severe brain injury. He was acting disoriented, going in and out of consciousness, not able to form verbal responses. To experienced EMTs and ER nurses, this behavior was not only strange, it was suspicious.
I learned a lot about the Glasgow Coma Scale.
Isn't it crazy?
It's very interesting. So when you have somebody who is showing signs of consciousness kind of going in and out, there's this scale where you can assess to what degree they are or are not likely to have a brain injury. So there's three different categories. One is the eye-opening response, one is a verbal response, and one is a motor response. For each of these categories, you can score some points, 4, 5, and 6 points respectively for those three categories for a total of 15. 15 points means you likely...
You're going to die.
No, actually, the opposite.
You're not going to die.
You're not going to die. 15 points is the maximum you can have. It's like, it's good. You've got all your points. You've got all your marbles. I think it like that way. And then for everything that you can't do, you lose some points.
Mm.
And so if you can have a maximum of 15, from sort of 13 to 15 would be like a minor brain injury if you were showing symptoms. From 9 to 12 points, so you're losing points now based on these different ways of assessing eye-opening response, verbal response, and motor response. From 9 to 12 points is a moderate brain injury. And then from 3 to 8 points, which is where Ian scored.
At that 7.
At that 7 indicates a severe brain injury, given the display that he was showing to the EMTs, like really groggy, can't really talk, like in and out of consciousness. This is why you can't fake it too much. If you do those things, they indicate that something really screwed up is happening inside your head. And if then they do brain scans and there's nothing going on inside your head to explain that behavior, it's pretty damn clear that you're faking it. This is why you have to know about things like the Glasgow Coma Scale if you're going to be faking a brain injury, dumbass.
But if you're the driver and you're Ian and you do know something about the Glasgow Coma Scale and you Google it just to make sure you got your shit straight, they're going to find that shit on your computer no matter what. You're screwed. You're done.
In your computer. That's right. Or you go to the you have to go to the library and use the computer there.
But you'll be on camera because they're in England and what their CCTV is like true. Out of control. See, this is what I'm saying. You can't not get caught.
Yeah.
You're going to get caught.
It's very true. It's very hard with forensics and electronic tracking. It's hard to get away with shit. You got to really think it through, people.
All these people who went before us, they really fucked it up for the rest of us.
They really did. And now it's too hard to get away with murder now.
I know. It's too much work. This is why divorce would have been easier, Ian.
Correct, Ian. Look how much trouble you caused yourself and everybody else.
Later that weekend, Ian Lawrence regained consciousness. Oh, miracle upon miracle.
Woo, imagine that.
It was sufficient enough to answer some questions, but he claimed so conveniently that he didn't remember anything from 5 p.m. onwards. That's usually me too, but for different reasons. Waka, waka, waka.
Oh, waka, waka, waka.
Oh, my God. Detectives felt confident that Ian Lawrence had planned and executed the murder of his wife and that he had attempted to disguise it as an accident. He was arrested on suspicion of murder. Just a month after Sally's death, Ian claimed that he all of a sudden remembered the events of the accident in a dream. As you do.
It's always in a dream. All right.
He said that he had an agonizing, I love this, leg spasm while driving along with Sally, and the spasm had caused him to involuntarily apply the accelerator. That only happens to old people, by the way.
That's right.
When asked why he didn't apply the brake, he said that his other leg also spasmed. This doesn't happen, Ian.
I know.
And somebody said, quote, he underestimates the people all around him because he has such a high opinion of himself.
Yeah. That's why he thinks he can get away with stupid shit.
Yeah, he does.
It reminds me so much of so many of these really narcissistic people that we see who are just either they're used to getting away with a lot of dumb shit. Like this person said, they just have such a high opinion of themselves and such a low opinion of others by comparison that of course I'm going to get away with it because I'm just so much smarter.
I'm that good.
I'm just that damn good.
Yeah.
So before we go onwards, let's just say a little about crash scene investigation, because like all aspects of forensics, we do like to talk about forensics in this podcast because we are so smart.
We're educating you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You can thank us by going to Patreon.
Yeah, exactly. How much would you pay for tuition at a college? Maybe give us that much money. I don't know.
The least you can do.
But like all manner of forensics, crash investigations have also undergone huge leaps in technology and in methods in about the past 30 years. Especially since onboard computers became a thing in cars. And cars, kind of just like planes, they have, you know, a black box part in them that can give a very precise record of everything that the driver did immediately before the crash. And crash investigators gather a huge amount of data to reconstruct exactly what led to an accident. And those things include, of course, the exact location, time, and date of the accident, the weather and the road conditions at the time, the number of injured people and fatalities, the presence of alcohol, drugs, or suspected alcohol drug use, puddles of gasoline, blood, or oil. I would change the order of those things, but okay. Debris, pieces of glass, pieces of the car like the fender, shredded or blown tires. This is one's important for our case. Skid, scrub, or gouge marks on the pavement, the ground, or stationary objects. Now, those are important because if your tires are locked and you are skidding on something like grass, it will look like a big drag mark.
Yeah.
Right? It'll really drag the grass. If the wheels are rolling, it means that the brakes have not been applied. And so if you don't see dragging tires, but you see the print of the tire, it indicates that at the time of the crash, those wheels were rolling. They were not locked. They were being driven forward.
You were not applying the brake, as you said.
And so the difference between, you know, a skid mark versus like a tire track is a very, very important piece of evidence. Also things like measurements, tons of measurements. You see people take that between the point of impact and where the vehicle came to rest. Pieces of private property that are thrown from the car at the impact can often indicate the degree of the impact. You know, if your purse is 10 feet away versus like 30 feet away, it indicates how hard you hit the tree, etc. And of course, where the vehicle came to rest after the accident and the damage that was done to it. The position of the turn signals, broken or missing seatbelts, or unbuckled ones, mofo, functioning headlights and taillights. All those things come into play. And then, of course, when the accident is reconstructed, once they have all this data and they have obtained witness statements, they can start to reconstruct the accident down to like, you know, hundredths of a second, really take it apart, really stretch out the timeline where something that really only took several seconds, they can talk about every tiny little part of what happened. And this process uses physics and mathematics, which, well, we do not agree with here, but we understand it's important to some people, but it's just not important to us. And they use it to determine the entire accident sequence, including speed and direction.
It's pretty impressive.
It is.
And it's all stuff that normal people would never consider.
That's right. And so when you're looking at something like the forensics around a car crash, if you are trying to make it look like an accident when it's a murder, you better be able to answer the kind of questions that these investigators are asking themselves. The story that you write with the evidence has to be a story that makes sense to them based on their professional understanding of what a normal straight up car crash would look like, you know? And if the pieces are just weird or they don't fit, I mean, red flag that barely begins to cover it. And all these investigators and EMTs and even just freaking bystanders are like, this is weird. There's something going on here. People could just tell it wasn't quite right.
Yeah. There's some maniac listening right now, like rewinding. What did she say? Okay, wait, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. Check, check,
right.
Check.
Check, check, check. I feel like we're not necessarily doing a public service right now.
I'm still Patreon, not going to give you $5. Any money on Patreon.
Right?
Well, the investigators who arrived on scene to determine how the accident actually happened were immediately suspicious. I'm also suspicious because he drove a red Peugeot, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
Investigators noted that visibility would have been quite good at the time of the incident and that the road surface had been dry. Also very important.
It is, man. Like a wet road makes a huge amount of difference.
Yeah. Because it's a dry road with good driving conditions. Like, what happened, pal?
Leg spasm!
Oh my, both of them, they turned on me right in the middle of my drive.
So at this point, there were several pieces of evidence that really started to solidify and form the backbone of this case. So we're just going to go through them one by one. The first one, most interestingly, was there was no sign of any kind of evasive maneuver or any kind of attempted escape from the path of the car that was leading towards the tree. So the police constable, Timothy O'Donnell, and I don't want to make generalizing statements, but that's just a hot level of words in a row. Police constable.
Timothy O'Donnell?
Police constable, Timothy O'Donnell. I bet he's wearing a uniform. So
if you're listening, police constable Timothy O'Donnell,
hook me up. Just I'm single just and ready to mingle.
I am not, but I will forward that email to Sally.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So there were several pieces of evidence at this point that really started to form the backbone of the case. And they started to emerge from all of these facts as really the most important pieces. The first piece was that there was no sign of any evasive maneuvers or attempted escape from this like path being driven towards this tree. So we've got police constable Timothy O'Donnell, who was a forensic collision investigator from the Leicestershire Police. And he worked the case and testified that, quote, the Peugeot began to negotiate the left-hand bend. It has to have made a right turn to generate the tire marks, but the marks are two straight lines. And that's telling me that there's no longer right-hand drive being applied. It's a straight path, straight towards the tree, end quote. And what investigators noticed was that there were, quote, escape routes. This is a phrase that is used. Escape routes means when you are apparently on a collision course with something, is there somewhere you can swerve to avoid that collision? And they were like, yeah, you could have swerved there. You could have swerved there. Apparently, like right next to the tree was an entrance to like a huge farmer's field. And it was only closed by like a pretty shitty gate. So if you are headed for a tree, or you could make literally like a 5-degree change in your course and like bust through a gate, like he could have avoided the tree if this was a real accident, slightly driven a little bit more to the right, busted through that farmer's gate and just kind of coasted to a stop in the middle of this gigantic field.
Yes.
But he did not. Police Constable Timothy O'Donnell noted that despite there being escape routes on either side of the tree, they were not used by Ian.
Oh, Ian.
But that's not all. There are other pieces of evidence that really definitely showed intent and method, and they definitely made it into the court.
Such as no sign of braking. Oh, Sally's Constable Hottie O'Donnell could not find any tire grinding, wink, wink, or feathering, that would suggest emergency braking. There is no indication that Ian had applied the brakes prior to the accident. The tires had rolled, not dragged, across grass and mud. This indicated no braking or locked wheels.
And then there's, of course, the fact that Sally's seatbelt had not been buckled at the time of impact, even though she was always known to wear a seatbelt. And it was also clear that Ian's seatbelt had performed its job admirably well in the accident. It had locked him in safely. It showed some scrapes and scratches that you would expect, but it had done what it was meant to do.
Sally had her overnight bag packed. Purse, phone, keys, all of it ready to go in the back seat of her car, a Jaguar, because she likes luxury.
Right, she's a classy lady. She drives a Jag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was clearly going somewhere and had plans and would not have left all of her stuff and then gotten into Ian's gross, nasty-ass hoopty.
Right, who leaves their purse, their phone, and their keys behind?
Nobody. No.
And this is why I'm just like, I think he must have somehow coerced her to get into the car.
Yes, exactly. Because those are things that you would think that she would at least take her phone.
At the very least.
At the very least. The first thing you automatically go to grab. I don't care who you are. It's the day and age that we live in. The first thing that you grab is your phone. And then your keys.
Yep. And even if it's something where it's like, oh, there's this emergency situation and we have to go right now. If there's an emergency situation, you're going to need your phone to make all the phone calls that you need to make. Right. Exactly. That's the first thing you need.
Even more reason.
Right. The other thing that happened was that the driver's side airbag had deployed, as we have mentioned, but the one that would have protected Sally Lawrence did not. Constable O'Donnell's examination of the airbag system could find no fault with it that would have caused it to malfunction without someone messing with it. And in fact, the car manufacturer Peugeot sent someone out from France to assist in the investigation and went over the car with a fine-tooth comb. The electronic control system that had controlled the airbag contained data that could be read by that Peugeot technician. It showed that the passenger airbag had been turned off 6 cycles, a cycle is the car coming on and then working and then turning off, had been turned off 6 cycles prior to the accident. So being able to turn off an airbag is actually a safety feature in case you, you know, you want to be able to put a child's seat in the front. One of the reasons you don't put a child's seat in the front is because if the airbag goes off, it's going to punch your child in the face. And people generally don't like that. You want to be able to disable it if you need to. In order to disable an airbag, it's not something you can accidentally do. You have to get the key to the vehicle. You have to insert it into a special socket to disable the airbag. You can't just accidentally do it. It must have been done intentionally.
At the trial, Ian Lawrence pleaded not guilty. Of course he did.
Of course.
When he was questioned, he claimed that he and Sally were, in his words, quote unquote, made for each other, and that they were soulmates.
Vomit.
He told the jury they never had heated arguments and they discussed everything, including dividing up their finances and assets without any anger.
Lies.
That's so great that you guys could be so amicable, Ian. Asshole.
He is an asshole.
His defense barrister, Mark Wall, Queen's Counsel, asked him, did you ever use violence against Sally? To which he replied, never. Then he was asked, did you ever threaten Sally? And he replied, never.
All lies.
Lies. All lies.
He did manage to squeeze out a few tears, though. Oh, he cried.
Little crocodile tears?
Little crocodile tears, yeah. He.
Oh, he's an actor.
He is. I mean, he did so well right after the crash, right? Right? He sold everybody on that unconsciousness act.
Bravo.
Ian Lawrence cried as he told the court, quote, it was an accident. She's my wife. It was an accident, end quote. Again, he claimed that moments before the crash, he felt this twinge in his left leg, pins and needles, and a numbness which rose up from his calf to his thigh. Doesn't it? Oh, it's terrible. He described it as a, quote, full-blown spasm or cramp, quote.
I get those every month, asshole.
Yeah, and I don't crash my ass car, so shut up. He said that the pain, which he claimed that he had experienced before, was excruciating. And he told the jury that he held onto the steering wheel really tightly and that his leg, which was stretched out, was, he said, quote, straight out on the accelerator, end quote.
Yeah, that happens to me too once a month.
Yeah, exactly.
Like just crying and my legs are stretched out on the accelerator.
And again, you don't crash your damn car.
Weenie, you can't take any kind of heat.
You really can't.
Ian claimed that Sally shouted right before the crash, "Look out!" And then he crashed. His lawyer asked Ian, "Did you plan to murder your wife last year?" To which Ian Lawrence replied, "No." His lawyer said, "Did you make sure her seatbelt was disabled?" To which Ian replied, "No." Mark Wall, Queen's counsel, said, "And did you somehow release her seatbelt?" Again, he said, "No." After the prosecutors provided their evidence and witnesses described Sally's increasing fear of Ian Lawrence, closing arguments were given and the jury was allowed to deliberate. After 8 hours, they found Ian Lawrence guilty of the murder of his wife, Sally, by an 11-1 vote. Her family and friends cheered and wept when the verdict was read.
Justice Leggett was the judge who presided over this trial, and after the guilty verdict was rendered, he needed to provide a sentence. When they do that, they always give these kind of sentencing remarks to justify their sentence. So this is kind of a long excerpt from Justice Leggett's sentencing remarks, but it's such a nice summary of the whole situation. I think it's worth reading. So buckle in. Quote, "It is clear to me from the evidence that you had two motives for murdering Sally. One was that you could not and would not accept that your marriage was over and were determined that Sally would never leave you. Your other motive was financial gain. You refused to accept that Sally should have the money from the house, although you had been advised that it was her due. In a text message Sally sent to her daughter the night before she died, and after you had told her that you wanted half the house and by rights should have more, as well as keeping all your other assets, Sally said, quote, 'I know money isn't everything, but to him it is,' end quote. You chose to murder Sally rather than lose her and face what you felt was the humiliation of divorce. But also, and just as importantly for you, to prevent her from getting the money from the house and to keep the house for yourself. The fact that you were motivated partly by financial gain is therefore one factor which makes your crime all the more serious. The law also punishes more severely crimes which involve the use of a weapon, particularly if the weapon is taken to the scene with the intention that it will be used. In this case, you did not arm yourself with a gun or a knife, but in disabling the passenger airbag and unclipping Sally's seatbelt before crashing your car into the tree, you made your car into a machine as lethal as any weapon and drove it to the scene with the intention of using it to kill. A third factor which makes your crime all the more serious is the high degree of planning and premeditation that went into it. The way in which you killed Sally involved a plan that you must have plotted out over days, if not weeks, in all its malevolent detail, and which you then executed with ruthless efficiency. My conclusion is that the minimum term which you must spend in prison before you can be considered for release, on license, is a term of 24 years. The 257 days that you have already spent in prison will be deducted from that. The result is that the sentence I pass is a life sentence, and you must stay in prison for at least the next 24 years. Less 257 days. End quote. I like that judge.
So a little over 23 years.
Yeah. I just like that he was very so precise. He's like, you know, I'll give you credit for the 257 days that you've already been in.
But not 258 days.
No, certainly not. I like how precise they are about these things.
It is nice. Mm-hmm. It is nice. The statement by Sally Lawrence's family was this, quote, We would like to extend our gratitude to the jury who have seen through the lies and the deceit of Ian Lawrence in his attempt to minimize his responsibility for the brutal murder of Sally. They have played a huge part in finally enabling this murderer to be held to account for taking our daughter, sister, and friend from us, and for taking a mother from her three children. End quote.
Fun facts. So many things happen in America, as we know, some of them good, some of them bad. And we're the firsts in many things.
We're number one
in things we shouldn't be number one in. And one of those things is the first serial killer to use a car as a weapon happened here in Michigan, United States. So this was Lawrence Paul Mills III of Garden City, Michigan. He appears to be the first serial killer, of course, serial killer being defined as two plus fatal separate kills, to use a vehicle as his weapon of choice. So Lawrence Paul Mills began his crime spree in 2017, but he was not apprehended by Chicago PD until 2020. He would approach his victims, who were usually sex workers. He would have sex with them in his car. And then after the transaction, when the sex worker was walking away from his car, Mills would drive towards them and basically just run them over and hit them with his car, sometimes repeatedly. And then, when they were incapacitated, he would take his money back.
What a dick.
Right? I was horrified. I was almost more horrified by that. I was like, that is the shadiest thing.
That is so rude.
I know. Dude, fucking that service is rendered, man. People earn that cash. You do not take it back. Anyway.
No refunds, pal.
You bang it, you buy it. After they were incapacitated, as I said, he would kind of go over their body and find the cash and take it back. And he hit women with his car in at least four and possibly five or more cases. Two
Damn.
Of them died, right? Police believe there may be more victims who were struck by his murder car, but survived, and they are urged to come forward to share their story. Last one is fun bags.
Fun bags.
Because airbags. I have had a direct experience with an airbag. I got sideswiped by a lady in a giant black SUV. I'm just driving along and then just like, bam, my airbag went off. And I was like, I didn't realize quite when an airbag goes off, it goes off like this. That's how fast it goes off.
Yeah, they're very fast.
It doesn't blow up. There's no perception from you that the airbag is blowing up. It's like you're driving along and suddenly there's this white thing in your face. It happens faster than your brain can process what's happening. Big white things just slamming into your face. It's a rough gig.
Yeah.
The idea of airbags has been around for over 100 years. The first airbag was invented for the covering of airplane and other vehicle parts. And it traces its origin to a United States patent submitted in 1919.
Damn.
By two dentists from Birmingham.
Always dentists, right?
Oh, the dentists, they have such good ideas.
Airbags and electric chairs.
I know, right? Some of the best inventions. Their names were Arthur Parrott and Harold Round.
Wow, of course it was.
Right? And that patent was approved in 1920. These kind of like air-filled cushiony bladders were kind of used as early as 1951, but the airbag, specifically designed for automobile use, is actually credited to an American. See, again, we're number one.
America!
John W. Hetrick. And he filed for an airbag patent on the 5th of August, 1952, and that was granted by the United States Patent Office on the 18th of August, 1953. So since 1953, Damn. Car airbags have been a thing.
Yet none of my cars that I owned from the 60s had them.
It took a long time for them to become like a big deal. Last fun fact, and I'm including it spontaneously, was that when I lived in Australia, my family owned three different vehicles. And all three of them were on the top three list of the least safe vehicles published by the Royal Automobile Association of Australia.
What were they?
They were a Nissan Pulsar, a Ford Focus, and a Daihatsu Charade.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember looking at it being like, oh, those are the three cars we own. Those are the three cars we own.
Top three, we own them all.
Top three, we own them all. Anyway, that's what we had. All right, that's it. Marriages fail. Things turn sour. Even after decades, feelings can change. Two people who previously had walked the same path find themselves heading in separate directions, the other person fading from view as their own path leads them away. It happens. I've been there myself. You don't expect, though, that even if your relationship fails, your partner's method of extricating themselves from the marriage would be to kill their spouse. Ian Lawrence, like so many of the murderers we profile, had both options in his hands at once. Divorce his spouse or kill his spouse. The choice Ian Lawrence made was driven by resentment, jealousy, and greed. Those base impulses ended the life of a person who was loved, admired, and needed by many people. Ian Lawrence's cowardly murder of his wife slashed a ragged tear through the lives of her family and friends, a tear that can never be mended. Despite the evidence against him, Ian Lawrence continues to maintain his innocence, an insult to those who love and mourn Sally. The death of one's mother is a blow that many of us continue to feel long after the last of the funeral flowers have withered and the vases emptied, washed, and put away. I cannot imagine the amplification of pain knowing that your father planned your mother's death and made it happen with his own hands. I'll finish with a quote from Justice Leggett, who, in his sentencing remarks, addressed the generational damage that Ian Lawrence has inflicted on his own family. Quote, "As we have heard from the statement that has been read out just now in court, the consequences of what you did have been devastating. Not only for Sally, whose life you ended so cruelly, but for her daughters and sister and for other members of her family and people who were close to her. Above all, for your own young son, whom you have robbed of his mother and who will have to live his life in the knowledge that she was murdered by his own father." End quote. You've been listening to Homicide Worldwide. So, Keita, if you were one of our listeners and you wanted to support us, what would you do and where would you go?
Well, one of the best ways that our listeners can support us is by going to Apple Podcasts and giving us a review and a rating, preferably 5-star, please. We hope you're enjoying our show. We really enjoy doing this and we would love to continue to do this. Apparently, there's an algorithm out there that helps us be noticed by other listeners. So the more reviews we have, the more 5-stars we have, the more people will listen, it'll catch on, and then we can stay around and continue to bring you murder. It's what you're here for.
That's right.
If you want to get a hold of the show and suggest anything, if you want to suggest a show idea or
anything you want us to stop talking about,
you can email us over at homicideworldwidepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram. We have two Instagrams. We have Homicide Worldwide Podcast and we have Homicide Worldwide Podcast Production. Those are both legitimate and you can find us there as well. Follow us, like our posts, invite friends to follow us. We also have a Patreon if you want to support us on Patreon because you love us so much and support the show over there. And just continue to tell your friends all about us, because that's the biggest thing. It helps us stay relevant and it helps people know that we exist, because that's a lot of people surprisingly don't listen to podcasts.
So you know what? If you like it and your buddies like it, please share. Yeah.
And the biggest thing is really just to give us a rating. That's the biggest thing. That helps us so much more than I even realized when we first started doing this, and probably a lot more than people out there really realize. It's a free way of supporting the show, and it means a lot to us.
Hey, you.
Want to get doomed?
I'm Tessa.
And I'm Nicole. And we have a spanking new podcast for your ear holes called Doom Generation.
Listen in as two foul-mouthed biddies have an always casual, often comedic...
What? I think we're funny.
...and sometimes chaotic conversation about the things that doomed us to be who we are today.
Take a trip with us down nostalgia lane and we'll try not to veer off the road.
Available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Doom Generation Pod and on Twitter at Doom Gen Pod.
Later, Doomers.
Hey, everybody. I'm Dane Holland.
It's a new STD, a sonic transmitted disease.
I'm Austin Shazam Pfeiffer.
So it would be just a smushed mashed potato situation going on in my young adolescent crotch area.
I'm Marcus Whitaker, known as I'm Electric Man.
So instead of talking about how CERN is trying to open up a portal to hell and end the entire universe, I guess I'm just going to read jokes off the freaking internet.
And I'm Austin Tiny Zen. Dr. Strange, he's circumcised because would you want an uncircumcised wizard? I don't think so.
And if you'd like any of that to make any sense whatsoever, tune in to Nerd It Through the Grapevine, a podcast where four best friends gather weekly to talk about our favorite parts of past, present, and future nerd culture every Monday on Spotify, iTunes, and whatever your favorite app for podcast is. Come join us in the Grapevine.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could definitely thank my grandmother for that.
Oh, I have a grandmother who was also emotionally
highly critical.
Oh, very critical. I can see your stomach. You should wear a girdle. It's 2001. I'm not wearing a fucking girdle.
Don't body shame me.
Don't body shame me. You look like the queen, and not in a good way.
He said that he had on an ongoing.
It's still happening.
It's not ending anytime soon.
Oh, it still hurts. Of course, where the veil, and of course, where the vehicle came to. Fuck me. Correct. Exactly. Yeah.
Just endless things of wonder to say about me.
People will come take rubbings of like the characteristic about you they like the best.
Yes, they'll just lay on top of my tomb and. Hope that they can just get a little bit of my soul.
As it like slowly rises to heaven.
You're disgusting. Get out.
Oh, hello. Oh. You could both visit at the same time.
Oh my God.
He puts the mountain mounty.
Ooh. All right. She's so serious.
I am serious. I am deadly serious. All right. I'm going to start that over. Or possibly not.
After the prosecutors divided their evidence. Well, it didn't have an airbag, but my mom did own in my lifetime. Several Pintos.
Wow. Several. She's still alive to tell the tale.
I know. It's crazy. And also, too, what year was that Focus? Because I had a Focus, and I would like to know if that was on the top three list of unsafe cars.
It was probably like mid-80s.
Wait, when did they start making the Focus?
I'm going to guess mid-80s.
Really? Oh, my God. What kind of car did he drive?
I don't know. I need to find out. I'm sure it was a terrible one, like a Pinto or an Aztec or a Prius.
Probably. Because they were around.
I just don't think a Prius could accelerate fast enough for somebody to run away from it.
Yeah.
to not run away from it. you know?
You, but you'd never hear it coming. The silent killer.
That's right.
You know?
That's just, right, the silent
killer. All you would hear is like the wind, and then it would be too late.